Now loose wig 7, side 4. And who are we siding with?
Your side 4. We do sincerely hope you will enjoy Tertian Organum, composed by Earl Zenders.
The king's daughter of the Frog Prince tale, on the day following the adventure at the well, heard a thumping at her castle door.
So she's sitting at table with Daddy, King Daddy, and Queen Mother, and a little princess in the middle. And they're doing very well with their golden plates and all, when up the front steps comes plop, 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 and she goes white. Bang on the door. Daddy says, "What's that? You seem disturbed." I says, "Just a little frog I met." And Daddy says, Daddy represents the principles and demands of the world of society and virtue and all that. And Daddy says, "Make any promises?" She says, "Well, yes." Well, he says, "Let him in." So in comes this candidate, and he's on the floor. He says, "I want to sit at the table with you." Oh, so she puts him there, and I spoils that meal. So she goes upstairs, and he's up there after her, and she says, "You could stay down there." He says, "I want in. I want in the bed." Now, the story has two or three versions at this point. The one that I like is the one where she picks the frog up and simply hurls him at the wall. And when that happens to a frog, it's not normally good for him. But in this case, it splits in half, and there stands this beautiful prince with eyelashes like a camel. And and the girl is enchanted. And the story says, and so they were married, and she introduced him next morning to Daddy. This is known in Sanskrit as a Gandharva marriage, a marriage of angels. No sooner is he introduced to Daddy than there is heard out under the porte cochere a coach drawing up, and it's the coach of the prince's land. Well, how come that this prince had become a frog? Anyone who's read his Freud knows why. He had been bewitched by a witch, who, as we know, is always mother. This is what had thrown him out down into the bottom of the well, and there he was as a frog now. And he finds his princess, his soul girl. He has gone down, so has she. This is where their divine marriage took place. And now there is revived the land. The coach comes to fetch them home. Now they've got an easy journey back. They're riding along the coach. It's being driven by a coachman whose name is Iron Henry. And they're going fine when they hear bang. And the prince says, "What's the matter, Henry? Did we break a spring?" "No," says Henry, "nothing of the kind. Ever since your departure, there have been four iron bands around my heart." This is the wasteland motif, the drowned man motif that Eliot speaks of in The Wasteland. So bang, 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 there are three more bangs, and that means that the restricting, killing thing has been broken, and the elixir is simply the return of this fulfilled youth. It's an optimistic story, and I like it particularly because it has both ends. The girl's quest and the boy's quest are both brought together here. He has been thrown out. She has lost her own joy in life, and it's from the bottom of the well that their redemption comes.
Changing deep blue sea, take me back, baby, find some changing me, everybody. They ought to change sometime, because it's soon or late I've been going out in our lonesome ground. Now change my money, change my honey, I chain babies just to keep them being funny, everybody. They ought to change sometime, because it's soon or late we have to go down in our lonesome ground. Now change my paint, change my shape. I change baby to get shed of the dirt, everybody. They ought to change sometime, because it's soon or late we have to go down our lonesome ground. Now I chain home, I chain town, I chain baby, all the way around everybody. They ought to change sometime, because it's soon or late we have to go down our lonesome ground. Now I chain walk, I chain talk, I chain baby, just keep on being bark, everybody. They ought to chain sometime, because it's soon or late we have to go down our lonesome ground.
Le Cantique du Noël. No, Pretty, don't talk.
Hey, shut up, Brian.
You want to move us away from this scene?
Yeah.
Let's do that.
Come on, Mark.
This quiz can't be there. Kenny, is he okay there? That's okay. I'll just start from the beginning. It doesn't matter.
Thank you.
goodness, never hit a clinker.
All the way in there.
When one has learned to let one's mind alone, so that it functions in the integrated and spontaneous way that is natural to it, one begins to show the special kind of virtue or power called De. A profound regard for De underlies the entire higher culture of the Far East, so much so that it has been made the basic principle of every kind of art and craft. While it is true that these arts employ what are to us highly difficult technical disciplines, it is always recognized that they are instrumental and secondary, and that the superior work has the quality of an accident. This is not merely a masterful mimicry of the accidental, an assumed spontaneity in which the careful planning does not show. It lies at a much deeper and more genuine level. For what the culture of Taoism and Zen proposes is that one might become the kind of person who, without intending it, is a source of marvelous accidents.
To be or not to be, that is the question. But there is no question about to be or not to be. See, because to be and not to be go together, as we saw, they arise mutually. There was, for example, a great Zen monk lived shortly after 1000 AD, who had a very peculiar way of painting. He had long hair, and he'd get very drunk on rice wine, then he'd soak his hair in ink and slosh it all over the paper. Then he would do a Rorschach test on it and decide what kind of a landscape it actually was, and then put in the finishing touches. And suddenly, out of this apparent mess, a great landscape would be evoked. But the whole art of the thing lay in putting in the finishing touches. And also, there's a very curious thing. If a person who is untrained in painting makes a mess with a brush, it's liable to be just a mess. Whereas if a person who has the feeling of painting in them for a long time, and they make a mess with a brush or just do anything, it looks interesting. When you get a piece of jade and look at its markings, you don't think of them as chaotic. When you see a dirty old ashtray with cigarette butts in it and rolled up bits of paper and pieces of Kleenex and things that everybody's throw away, you know that that's a mess. And you don't want that kind of a mess around. You get rid of it. But when you look at the patterns on rocks, or the shapes of clouds, or the outlines of trees, you've got something which isn't orderly in the sense of being symmetrical. It doesn't form fours, you know? But you know it's beautiful. Blue mountains are spontaneously blue mountains. White clouds are spontaneously white clouds. They just do that, you see? It's their game. But they are definitely something that we recognize as having an order and not being chaos. But we can't quite pin down wherein that order consists. So there is this always ungraspable, indefinable principle of order in things, which is Li. And that explains why Chinese art appreciates in all that it does a certain element of the uncontrolled. Now you see, when you use, for example, a brush, the brush runs a little dry, and you're at the mercy of the hairs of this brush. Now some painters like to let everything go wild, but what the ideal that they're aiming at is, and which you have to be a tremendous master to accomplish, is to let it go wild within limits. Create a situation which overall is orderly, but allows for the unexpected, random surprises.
By the way, this is Eric Laffey with the group with
Eddie Armour on flugelhorn, Edgar Bateman on drums, Richard Davis on bass, Herbie Hancock at the piano, and Eric, yes indeed. Of Eric Dolphy with the quintet in the background.
God behaved like a monster to Job. This was a perfectly ruthless, atrocious job. His friend the devil comes and says, "You think Job is a good man and respects you. That's because you've been good to him, but you treat him badly and watch." God says, "I'll bet." And it was on. And then they started to work on this poor man, and you know what happened. House gone, family gone, everything gone, health gone. He ends up on a pile of ashes with a case of bad boils and so forth. And his friends come to him and say, "Job, you must really have been bad to be punished this way." And he said, "Nothing of the kind, I haven't." And he was right. And the point was, he was punished not because he was bad, but because he was good. And finally, his insistence on the fact that he had not misbehaved brought God himself to show himself. And what did God say? Did he say, "Look here, you've been great, Job. I had this bet and I've won." No, he didn't say that. Nor did he try by any roundabout rationalization to explain this thing in decent terms. It was an indecent act. He simply said, "Are you big? Could you fill Leviathan's nose with harpoons? I did. Try it. See how you can do. Who are you, you little worm, to address yourself to the problem of what I'm doing?" And Job abdicates his human judgment and says, "O Lord, who is man that thou shouldst regard him? I have heard of thee with mine ears. I behold thee with mine eyes. I put ashes on my head. I'm ashamed." That is the submission of the human judgment to the divine mystery.
Thank you.
Now, the legend with respect to Bodhisattva is that as he was about to deliquesce, you know, in the last rapture of nirvanic realization and no longer return to the world in the round of rebirths, he heard the clouds and trees and rocks and all send up a cry of lament. And he asked, why this? And the cry were then explained. They said that your presence here has given us a realization of the imminence of nirvana, and your departure will deprive us of this. And so he resolved to remain in the world, to keep coming back, not to leave, but to represent the imminence of nirvana in the world. Now that's the meaning of that Tibetan saying, Om Mani Padme Hum. Mani Padme means the jewel is in the lotus, the jewel of nirvanic realization, that is to say, the dimension of mystery, the dimension of consubstantiality, the dimension of illumination is right imminent here. This is the golden lotus world, whether you see it as such or not. In its horror, in its banality, in its cruelty, in its lust, this is the nirvanic world. And it's not to be corrected. It can't be corrected. What is to be corrected is your optical dress. So unless you can see that, you will not realize that it's operative here. Now, this one whose being is illumination. Bodhi means illumination. Sattva means being. He whose being Sattva is illumination remains in the world. And the notion is that he operates through us in our consorting with each other. Whether we are intentionally striving to illuminate each other or not, we are doing so all the time. And this is the operation of Avalokiteshvara's compassion, karuna, in the world. He is a...